And people who are here today, we have an issue with duplicating, and they are trying to resolve the problem. And things are going to come to us as we move along in the agenda. So we're going to do our best just to stay with the agenda that is before us so that we have the materials that you need to review. So for now, we have Senator Sieben. Senate file 455 is the first one. Again, you don't have everything in your packets, members, but you will in a few minutes. Senator, we don't have quorum yet. People will be coming in, but you can begin to present your bill, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. This is Senate file 1228 is the Senate, our elections omnibus bill. And the section that pertains to your jurisdiction is related to a task force that would study the potential emergency situations that would impact elections. So it's Article 1, Section 52 of the bill. And the rationale behind designing this task force is that There is limited guidance in state statute about what would happen if there was an emergency situation, we thought that it would be advisable or that it would be beneficial to convene a task force of interested stakeholders to advise the legislature on these, how to address emergency situations and possible expenses related to an emergency that would impact elections. So, I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory in terms of the language. I'm happy to go through it, or the language was modeled after other task forces that have proceeded through the legislature. The people that would be on the task force include the Director of Public Safety or a designee, the Secretary of State, an individual designated by the Secretary of State's office, the Minnesota Adjutant General or a designee, a county auditor, a professional emergency manager, a town election official.
Madam Chair. Sorry, Senator Sieben.
Yes, Senator Pearson.
We don't have the bill in front of us, so
My sincere apology. They just were diligent on getting you the summary of the entire bill, but we just need that page, and I think our staff is confused with
the process. That's a summary. That's not the actual bill.
Sorry, Senator Sieben, you have to pause for a moment. Here, take my
So, Madam Chair, if members have, I just heard Senator Pappas say Senate File 455. That was the original bill that is now folded into the elections omnibus bill, which is Senate File 1228.
Senator, what happens is that
Wait a second. It is the omnibus bill is Senate File 455, and 1228 was the elections, the emergency task force that's established.
Madam Chair.
Senator,
We have two copies of the summary instead of a copy of the summary and a copy of the bill. It's
coming. Okay. If you let me explain what's happening here. Senate file 455 is what we will be reviewing in my committee. There is only one page out of that bill that is under the jurisdiction of this committee, but they printed the entire bill. Fortunately, this is a massive bill. I really don't want all of this paper to be wasted, and I just don't believe that we should review this entire bill. But it's done the way it is, so hopefully you will not see that on Wednesday and Friday. But for today, the bill that you have to review that is in front of you is Senate File 455, and you have to go to page 27. And we are only reviewing the task force. If you do not have that bill in front of you, please let me know. So it's section 52, and Senator Sieben will just simply present the Elections Emergency Planning Task Force, which is in page 28. So, Senator, if you could proceed to explain that.
So, Madam Chair and members, as I was saying, and I can start over, but I was just describing the membership of the people who would be on this task force. And again, the point of the task force is to make recommendations to the legislature for how to plan what to do in the case of emergency situations in regard to elections. And so continuing on, again, we're on Article 1, Section 52, now on page 28. The other officials, I'm on lines 28.13, election official appointed by the League of Cities, a school district official appointed by the School Board Association, a representative appointed by the Speaker, one by the Minority Leader of the House, one senator by the Majority Leader, a senator by the Minority Leader, the Senate Minority Leader, and as you'll see, the duties are outlined on 24 lines 28.24 through 28.30. And then, as you'll see, it's, as I said, language similar to other task force. The meeting would be convened by the Secretary of State prior to August 1st, and the members of the task force would elect a chair and a vice chair, and then the compensation is similar to other task forces that have passed through this body. So with that, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Members, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Sieben. To what extent, and I don't know, to what extent does current law contemplate like continuity of government or in the event that there is something that prevents the election from taking place the day it's supposed to take place or the Constitution for that matter? And I don't know the answer.
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, current law provides for postponing some elections in very specific circumstances. So local elections that aren't held in conjunction with a state or federal election can be postponed due to inclement weather, for example. But statute doesn't provide for dealing with other types of emergencies. For instance, like if there was a massive power outage or a snowstorm that would take place. The state is limited in its ability to postpone a federal election, but there are possible scenarios that it would be helpful to have more planning done in place. For example, if there was a special election for a legislative seat scheduled on the same day as a large storm, a snowstorm was forecast, we could establish a process to postpone that election. So, for instance, if there was a special election because you resigned for your seat but it coincided with a snowstorm, the statutes are silent on what we could do in that circumstance. So, and when I started talking to council about different ideas for what to do in those types of situations, it quickly became clear that it would be better to convene a group of stakeholders to look at these different scenarios and come forward with recommendations rather than try to introduce a bill and move forward with it right now.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have, I guess I'm trying to get at is, to what extent does anybody have the authority to change elections, general elections in particular? I don't have the Constitution in front of me. I'm trying to get a hold of it. It has to be outlined specifically in the state constitution, I would imagine.
Madam Chair, I don't know specifically about the state constitution. I don't know if council could help me or the Secretary of State's office. But I do know that the state statutes can determine, for instance, when special elections are held or we could do in the event of a power outage or a an emergency. There is precedent, and there is it's within our authority to establish guidelines for what would happen if there was an emergency situation. So again, you are correct, though, that federal law doesn't allow us to reschedule a federal election, for example. But I think that there was enough questions about what we should do in the event of emergency that it made sense to convene a group of stakeholders to talk through these issues and then come forward with recommendations after this group digs into it more.
Good.
Any other questions, members? Any other comments?
I do.
Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, I do have just a general comment on the bill. As you know, understanding the direction was we're most particularly concerned about the task force. However, under the rules, all of the bill is always germane in a committee. So we have the right to speak about any provision within the bill. And I would just express my disappointment in the manner in which this bill is being brought forward. I don't know which one of these items is going to be moving separately, but there are certainly items within the bill that I do support. There's some that I don't. And it's unfortunate that members are put in a situation to have to potentially vote against a bill when some of these, I believe, could pass off the Senate floor with a strong bipartisan vote. So I understand that's the way of doing things around here. This isn't my first rodeo, if you will, but I think some of these, particularly these items that have taken a lot of work to build bipartisan coalitions, namely, for example, the felony voting rights restoration bill, there's been countless hours being put into that, and for me to have to cast a no vote on that as the lead Republican co-author is too bad. So that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Madam Chair.
I think that is well noted. I think we've struggled with some of these bills that, you know, create an entity to do something that is quite significant, whether it's a task force or a group, and then it gets complicated for us to review the entire bill. This is a quite complex bill, but you're going to have plenty of opportunities to talk to the author. Senator Stephen, quickly, if you may, we have a long agenda and we started so late.
Senator Peterson, that bill that you specifically mentioned is also moving on its own. So I understand your concern, but that was done at the bequest of the author.
Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, Senator Stephen, can you tell me why we do omnibus bills for policy? I can kind of understand it for a budget, but why do we do that for policy bills?
Senator Stephen.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, that's a larger question, but I think that in my experience with working on election issues, because there's been this long-standing precedent that goes back to the Pawlenty administration and I think even before that, that election bills generally need bipartisan support to become law, they're quite controversial, or pieces of it are, and I think really the it's done more for a matter of managing floor time. With individual bills coming forward and being germane for a whole variety of election issues, a lot of times we put them into an omnibus bill to conserve time, and it just seems to have served us well on a bipartisan basis in the past. And I don't know. That's what we decided to do again this year.
Okay. Well, thank you. I don't know if I agree with it, but I appreciate that point of view.
Thank you. So somebody wants to move the bill.
So moved.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 455 be recommended to pass and sent to Judiciary. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, members.
Members, this has to go to Judiciary, and there were no amendments put in to this bill. So if you would please recycle this, we would totally appreciate it, so that we don't have to kill more trees. So if you could give it to staff. Next, we have Senator Franson. Apparently, she has to go to present another bill. So, Senator Franson, you have Senate File 735. I think you have that with you, members.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Actually, I appreciate the making room in my testifier, Mr. Professor Lee Munich has to be gone earlier than the committee, so we want to make sure we get his testimony for the committee's convenience. So Senate File 735 is an establishment of a road user working group, user charge working group, otherwise known as a mileage user base working group. And this bill came from the Transportation Policy Committee, and it will go back there for more substantive discussion. At this point, it does establish a working group, so that's the jurisdiction of your committee, and it will certainly have some duties of the working group. Professor Lee Munich has been working on this issue for many, many years, and I have him here just to give a quick overview of what the committee, the working group, will be doing, what they would be focusing on, and a little brief context of the issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chairman, thank you.
If you could please introduce yourself.
My name is Lee Munich. I'm a senior fellow at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. And
Dr. Munich, if you don't mind, I just neglected to issue a statement that for the record, we had quorum for the last bill, and we do now have a quorum. My apologies. Please continue.
Madam Chairman, I gave a longer presentation the other day to the Transportation Committee, but I'll give a briefer one to you. There should be a copy of a handout in your file that has a couple of slides on it, just to show you a couple of key points about why this issue is being considered and why the Transportation Committee is exploring whether the state should go further. There are currently 28 states, and there's a map that shows the states that are involved in studying some form of mileage-based road charge as a future replacement of the gasoline tax. Oregon has been the leading state, and I'll say a few words about that, but the second chart here shows how much state and federal gas taxes are paid annually by Minnesota residents, depending on the number of miles that they drive. And as you can see by this chart, if you drive 15,000 miles per year and have a 20 mile per gallon light duty truck, you pay $214 in taxes. If you have a 40 mile per gallon hybrid, you pay $107 per year in state taxes. If you have an electric vehicle, you pay no gas taxes. The problem that this creates, even though it's good that more people are driving fuel-efficient vehicles, is that the user-based system that we've had in transportation is declining. A problem for local governments in specific is that currently 47% of the transportation costs are borne by local governments. And if there isn't a replacement for the gas tax in the future, that's just going to increase, and people will be paying more property taxes for transportation services. The second thing I wanted to highlight is that the state of Oregon has recognized this as a problem and has passed legislation to begin a per-mile road usage charge. And a couple of slides here just showing key information about how they plan to implement that on July 1st. They plan to recruit 5,000 volunteers who will start paying mileage-based fees and then be reimbursed for their gas tax payments. And so that's basically what I wanted to indicate. It's a question of future funding of the transportation system. This is not something that will happen soon, but could happen over a longer period of time. And the working group would study that issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an amendment as well of the bill, and it basically, the change that it would have, we made some changes in the Transportation Policy Committee. This amendment came from Senator Osmick, who made a point of, we currently have one of the charges of the committee of the working group to assess the ability to pay as a factor in their criteria of things they can look at with regards to this road user fee. And Senator Ress also agreed that that was too broad, that we needed to really explain what the ability to pay would be. So we changed it to more language that has been used in other other bills and other legislation where it talks about the regressivity or the progressivity of a tax. So that's the reference to that section in statute, and to really look into the issue from the potential implications to any disparate impact on the users based on geographic location of their residency. So that's the background on the amendment.
This is an author's amendment. So, Senator Pappas, do you
Madam
have a
Chair,
question?
It's not the first committee, so it's not really the author's amendment.
Okay.
So, but she explained it. So I'll move the A6 amendment.
All of those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Any questions for the testifier or Senator Francis? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to know if Ms. James has reviewed this. It doesn't really say when the working group is supposed to be established by. Do we need to have that in there, or you think that's we don't need it?
Madam
James.
Madam Chair and members, it if you look at lines 3.14 through 3.16, it has a requirement for a deadline for the appointments and designations.
The expiration.
And then the expiration, and then a deadline for the report. So those things should be enough, although we could add a deadline for the... Oh, it has the first meeting also. That's on lines 3.2 through 3.3.
Great.
Then any Madam other Chair? Questions, members? Senator?
Madam Chair, I would...
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Franson, I say this on a lot of these sorts of bills. One of the problems that I have with the approach that you're putting forward is it's sort of presumptive in nature, in that the committee has got a whole host of charges to think about and articulate ways in which this thing can be done, and not, although it does say may recommend, the situation is such that these things are always You design a working group with the express purpose of working on an issue. They will work on the issue. So it's not an open-ended question with regard to how to finance transportation, but rather a specific charge to think about this one specific way and then articulate all the benefits of doing so. Generally, I have a problem with that approach. I'll be voting no on the bill, but one particular item of concern, if you go to line 2.4, actually the sentence begins in 2.2, in considering relevant issues, the working group shall consult and utilize recommendations and findings contained in, among other sources, and then you specifically enumerate a source for which they should consider. And along with the bill being generally presumptive, I would say that's, again, they certainly could do that without the specific language referring to it, but to enumerate that as a shall consider item, again, builds in bias into the work of that group. And so I would move to strike that sentence in its entirety from line 2.2 to 2.5, understanding this bill is going to pass anyways, but I at least hope that we can remove that specific reference, because I do think it builds in an inherent bias into the work. And again, I have no doubt the working group will look at it anyways without the specific sentence, but I don't think we should be mandating it in the bill. So I would move that amendment.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, and Senator Peterson, I don't think, though, that they are pretending to be a group that's going to look at alternative ways to pay for our transportation system. I think it specifically is—it's a narrow focus that says we're going to look at a road user charge as an alternative to motor fuels tax. So I think in that context, I would agree with you if they were saying we're going to look at all kinds of, 10 different ways that we might be able to fund transportation. But I think it's very narrowly focused on this, seeing is this in particular a feasible way to do it.
Senator Franson, what is your...
Madam Chair, and just for context, Senator Peterson and Senator Pappas, in 2011 or before 2011, there was results that MnDOT had created a mileage base user fee task force and reported the results in 2011. So we've already studied this from a state perspective. It also, later in 2013, the department had another testing, and the U of M has, the Humphrey Institute in particular, but the U of M has had a lot of work in this area from an academic standpoint, from an academia standpoint. That's where Professor Lee Munich has his expertise and has worked on this for many years. And it's been a very comprehensive group of folks that have been part of that group, including policy makers and elected officials that have served in those task forces. So it's really using work that we've done before that we presumably have already been funding through our taxpayer dollars through the U of M. So it really, they'll look at it anyway. I think you're right. So if that's a big burden to have that specifically stated there, it's a point of really utilizing something that we've already done and leveraging it in this particular task force, in this particular working group. So we don't lose that knowledge, whatever that knowledge pointed to. But from additional background, in our previous committee, we did have this discussion and whether this is too predetermining the results of this report or this working group, and we made changes such as the may used to say shall or must, so we changed that as well. To that point, committee members felt strongly about that, so that was a friendly amendment. So we're trying to not be prescriptive or presume what the results are, but we certainly want to leverage what work has already been done in our state.
Senator Francis, so is your intention that this group will not reinvent the wheel, that they depart from something that has already been done, that there is some information that they must use in order to build on that?
Madam Chair, I think certainly leveraging what's already been done, and in our transportation committee, someone made a comment that, you know, Oregon, the state of Oregon, has used our research to start their efforts in this area, and back. So we leverage from other states as well. So we certainly don't want to reinvent the wheel, but we want to make sure we update our findings and see what Oregon's doing as well, and whether that's it's a national trend. So to ignore some of this information that's happening or some of these options that we have, we want to make sure that we understand what those implications are. So that's the main focus of the working group, but leverage what we the talent and the work that's already been done as well.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Senator Franson, I don't think my point is to suggest that you ignore anything. I think there's a difference between being silent and mandating a particular way to look at it. And so certainly I believe you 100% that this working group is going to, in fact, go to that source. But as a matter of precedent, we should think about establishing working groups and then telling them the sources from which they derive their information. I think is not a good way to go about policy. It's not going to change the world in this case, and I understand that. But when you create a working group, I would hope that it's to some degree an open-ended, we're trying to collect all the information that's available, and if this were an issue maybe that was more offensive to the majority, that outlined a particular source that they didn't necessarily like for whatever reason, I think that it would be just as valid of a concern, and I would support that motion because it's not the best way to go about the process. So I did move an amendment to strike that line.
So Senator Peterson moves
lines,
to strike,
I should say.
Starting in considering line point
2.2,
all the way to opportunities and 2.8, correct? Or I don't remember what he's.
Yeah, it's that sentence. So 2.2 after the period to 2.5 after the period.
2.5 after the period. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm.
You clear on that?
I Senator support the will Fred. Of the committee on this amendment.
Senators, any other questions on the amendment? If not, all of those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Division.
Division. Okay. Those.
I should have just asked for a roll call on the front side, since I knew it was going to split vote anyway.
I just couldn't hear very well. So all of those in favor, please raise your hands. Thank you. So the amendment is passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did get ahead of myself. I did have another amendment, and that was the A4, and that was suggested by council. I don't know if members have that amendment.
A4. Do we have the amendment? Just a minute, Senator. We had a duplication.
Madam Chair and members, yes, in the duplicating flurry, I don't think that we ended up with the members having it. I can describe it orally if you would like.
Sure. So Ms. James is going to read the amendment.
This is on page 2, line 10. Delete everything after the second the. And insert chairs of the committees in the Senate and the House of Representatives with primary jurisdiction over transportation policy and transportation finance. And then page 2, line 11, delete everything before the period. And so this changes the reporting requirement to what we customarily do with these working groups, is to have them report to the relevant chairs in the legislature, as opposed to sending a report to the Legislative Reference Library, which is what happens under those statutory sections.
Members, do you have any questions? Senator Dahl?
I move that amendment.
All of those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Any other questions for the senator or for testifier? If not, Senator Pappas moves Senate File 735 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to finance. All of those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you,
Members.
Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, we have Senator Sparks. Oh, he's stuck in committee. So who do we have? Senator Nino, are you here? Yes, Senator, welcome to our committee. Senator Nino has Senate File 1095. I believe you have this in your packets. Is it coming?
Yep, I have it.
Please, Senator Nino, go ahead and start
Madam
your
Chair.
Presentation.
And I do have two handouts. If we could have a page, distribute those to the members, and there are extras if anyone wants. Madam Chair, for the sake of the committee's time, I will be brief. This is a piece of legislation. It's not identical in language, but it is the principally the same proposal that was passed out of this committee a year ago. As I recall, there was not any opposition. It was a voice vote. I don't recall any no votes on it. The language is slightly different than what was passed out. I think the language at that time included some wording about including city council members or whatnot, and that is not in this current version of the bill. What is being handed out to you right now, at the time this bill was passed a year ago, the city council of North Branch did support it. What is being handed out to you is a reaffirmation of that support, a letter from the city council dated in November reaffirming their support, and then also an email from the city administrator in January, I believe it was. It was sent to one of my state representatives that where the city council had reaffirmed their support by voting against a negative proposal to not support this. So the city council has and continues to support this proposal. The bill before you is very straightforward. It simply says that the city of North Branch, which has a municipal power and light, can expand their board from 3 members to 5 if they so choose. The bill is permissive. It does not require them to do so. It's completely at the discretion of the city council. What this would do for them, for those that aren't familiar, the city of North Branch is in Chisago County, straight north of here. You go straight up I-35 in about 45 minutes, or depending on traffic, an hour or so, you'll hit the city of North Branch. A relatively small community. That's where I grew up, in Chisago County. Stacy is my hometown. North Branch is where I went to high school for 10 years. A relatively small community with a board of 3. Anytime one of those two people are together, they constitute a quorum, potentially, at least under some interpretation of state law, and can be problematic. Allowing for a board of five will eliminate that particular problem and expand some additional input into the oversight of their municipal power and light. That is the bill in front of you. It's very straightforward. I don't want to spend any more time trying to sell it or explain it. If you have questions, I will welcome those and do my best to answer. There may be some testimony in opposition, but that is the bill before the committee.
Thank you, Senator. Do you have any questions, members, for the senator? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify? You could please approach the table.
Madam Chair.
Identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Kirsten Hagen Kennedy, Mayor of North Branch, Minnesota. Madam Chair, committee members, I am before you today as the Mayor of the City of North Branch, along with Council Member Kathy Bloomquist, a council member of the past 12 years, both of whom are opposed to this legislation. During my campaign, I knocked on hundreds of doors. Taxes and the high water and sewer bills were the number one concern of my citizens. As a mayoral candidate, I found citizens overwhelmingly supported maintaining the historic three-person water and light commission. I made clear my opposition during the campaign and was surprised the previous council voted at the 11th hour after the election in December and prior to my swearing in to push forward this legislation. The three-member water and light commission structure has been in place for 7 decades. Historically, the commission remained autonomous and non-political. As for the Water and Light Commission's letter of support, please note the Water and Light manager, Senior Commissioner Daryl Fisk, as well as former member Commissioner Rick Halls, did not support this. Community members have spoken on record in opposition of this legislation. I am asking to retain the state statute of a three-member commission. I am asking you today to vote no on Senate File 1095. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Senator Peterson, if let me ask the other testifier, and then we'll proceed with questions.
Okay.
Please introduce yourself. And
okay. My name is Kathy Bloomquist, and I am on the North Branch City Council. I was just elected for my fourth term, and I have lived in the city of North Branch since 1973. I served on the Water and Light Commission from 2002 to 2008. I have seen the commission successfully overhaul an electrical system that was out of date. All of the electrical lines have been buried, so there are no longer any electrical poles in the city. The city at one point was desperate to find water, and the commission worked together to find the water the city needed. Our manager is extremely knowledgeable about electrical and water requirements. Our commission has the technical expertise and knowledge to manage the day-to-day operations. At this point, all of the necessary infrastructure that the city of North Branch needs for electricity and water are in place to move our city forward. My biggest concern is that more people on the commission will cause delays in needed expenditures. Unless we can appoint people who have an extensive background in utilities, I believe decisions will take too long and could impact the electrical and water service to the people in our city. The citizens served by the Water and Light Commission are used to prompt, efficient, and reliable service. Decisions need to be made in a timely manner in the interests of the users. In 2011, the City of Melrose requested legislation to increase the membership of their PUC from 3 to 7. The legislation never became effective by the city. Today, there are still 3 members on their PUC. I would also urge you to vote no on this particular legislation.
Senator Nino and then Senator Peterson. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify for the sake of the members on the committee, the Honorable Mayor and the council member here, they have every right to be here as individuals, and the committee should listen to their input as such. They are not here speaking on behalf of the city. Just to clarify, with the email that I sent to you from the city administrator, the city council refused the motion by Mayor Kennedy to not proceed with this legislation. The city council effectively reaffirmed their intent and their support for moving forward with this this bill. I am here at the request of the full city council, and that's the only reason why I'm here.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Nino, just to get clarification, your bill doesn't require that the city have five members on the board. It simply allows the elected council to make that decision, correct?
Senator Nino.
Yes, Senator, that is correct. The bill is fully permissive. If the city council, if the two members here, the Honorable Mayor and the city council, can convince one of their colleagues to vote with them, they could certainly reject this and continue in perpetuity if they maintain that their support with a three-member board. But in the event that the city council wants a five-member board, they would have the option to do that.
Senators, do you have any other? Senator Peterson?
Madam Chair, I would move Senate File 1095 for passage or referral.
Members, do you have any other questions? Senator Dahl?
Madam Chair, I don't want to jump into the politics of North Branch, but I wish there was a little more cohesion on the council and with the mayor and the councilor itself. So I'll probably be voting no at this time, and just to let the author know.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Nino, or to your testifiers, I take it, Ms. Kennedy, this is your first term as the mayor?
Correct.
Senator Nino, was the former mayor in favor of this legislation?
Senator Nino.
Senator, yes, that is my understanding. As I recall, the way the votes were, that the mayor was supportive, the previous mayor was supportive.
Okay, thank you.
These are, you know, some of the issues about us having to intervene with local government. It puts us in kind of an awkward place, I mean, especially for those of us who are not quite fully familiar with what's going on at the local level. But Senator Hall.
Thank you, Doris Frey, Madam Chair. I just want to say I agree with you. I think letting them make their decision and having that ability is probably the way I will certainly vote. So I think that local government being able to make it and make that decision for themselves and that ability to do that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Yeah, I think it's we all deal with our own local government challenges and trying to figure out, you know, how to bring them together. Well, on Senator Peterson's motion, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
No. The motion is not adopted.
Division.
Okay. Division has been called. All of those in favor of the motion, please raise your hands. Thank you. The motion is not adopted. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senators.
Next in the agenda, we have Senator Scalzi. Okay, Senator Scalzi, my apologies, but it seems like your bill is being printed, too. It's an. So what do we have? Do we have Senator
Sparks.
Dahl? What do we have?
Yes.
We have Senator Dahl. Senator Dahl, if you could please.
I don't know if you have
Senate
my bill
file
either.
1506. Yes, we do.
You do?
Okay. Apparently, we do have your bill here.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, we do have your bill. You're sending us bills as they print it, so it's just that some of these bills are so big, fortunately, and what we have to act on is just very small provisions.
Madam Chair and members, I have an agency bill, Senate File 1506 from the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I'll briefly just give you an overview of what the bill does, and then I have Tammy Post, the Chief Judge of the Office of Administrative hearings here to clarify or answer any questions that you might have. This proposal would actually save public money to increase public access to the process in two ways. First, rather than requiring the Office of Administrative Hearings to mail various notices to all property owners affected by the proceedings and then to publish a notice in the state register, this proposal maintains the mailing requirement but deletes the publications in the state register in favor of publication in a local newspaper of general jurisdiction in the effective area. This is the process used for most municipal boundary adjustment matters, a process that ensures the public is fully informed. And second, the current statute requires that hearings be held within 60 days, but also requires that the local municipalities and landowners engage in mediation. Because it's often difficult for the parties to complete mediation within the time frame, the amendment allows these cases to be scheduled quickly but flexibly in order to encourage parties to explore settlement options and save the costs of a hearing. So as we look at the bill itself, you can see that while it looks rather lengthy, we're just by eliminating the lines, for example, on page 1.14, that particular section is not required anymore. And then later on throughout the bill, we've crossed out state register, replaced with newspaper of general circulation for the territory of the proposed district. So I think that's pretty typical throughout, just those two changes. So I'll let my testifier add any additional comments.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tammy Poost. I'm the Chief Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. And Senator Dahl has well explained the bill. It really is just a housekeeping bill to make sure that we're not adding additional costs to the municipalities and other participants in these proceedings by having them file in this or publish things in the state register, which is not something that most of the people around the state look to find their notices. Instead, they look in their general newspapers, and so that's a change that's made throughout. There's also some clarifications, and the only one that's really substantive is the one that Senator Dahl mentioned about the scheduling. Right now, the law says that we'll hold these hearings between 30 and 60 days from the date of filing, and yet we'll require the sanitary district participants to go to mediation. They simply can't find mediators out state that are necessarily available within that schedule. And so we'd like to be able to schedule these hearings within 30 to 60 days, but then grant continuances upon request to the parties to make sure that they're exploring alternative dispute resolution processes, which is cheaper for everyone concerned.
Thank you. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to our testifier. So what is the state register?
State register, I suppose. Madam Chair and members, State Register is a publication of the Secretary of State's office where all state contracts are published, all requests for proposals of state agencies are published, and so state governments and municipal governments sometimes are used to looking in the State Register to find out what's happening on the state level of government. But when you're creating a sanitary district involving two townships or two municipalities out in greater Minnesota, the members of those communities aren't necessarily going to be looking in the state register to see if there's a change in their local government. Instead, they'd be looking in their local newspaper.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to our testifier again. So what about those people that don't look in their newspaper, that don't get newspaper? And what is this going to cost you or us as a state to put it in a newspaper?
Madam Chair and members, it's actually the participants or the we're the court that hears the proceedings, so the parties that bring it would need to publish in their local newspaper as opposed to paying the cost to publish in the state register. That's not a free service either. And as to, I'm sorry, I forgot the first part of your question.
I did too. my concern is, I look at newspapers as kind of going out of style. Everybody's getting online. So the typical person would go online if they want to know something about this, and I would think if they know where to go, Secretary of State's office or something, that'd be an easier way to publicize this. Plus, I was concerned about the cost.
Madam Chair and members, with regard to the public notice, other parts of the statute that aren't being amended require that the municipalities that are involved in these proceedings put notice of the proceeding on their own website, and people can sign up to get notices with regard to particular pending proceedings, and then as a part of our process at the Office of Administrative Hearings, we actually mail out notifications to them. So there's a lot of different ways that we give the public access to participate in the proceedings, and it's really our understanding and belief that this makes it more accessible, not less.
Senator Hall.
Thank you. Just last statement. I've been kind of looking at notices going into newspapers, and we've had a few bills over the years that have dealt with that. For me, I know a lot of people like that. Those notices are put in there, but for me, we're subsidizing the newspapers with a lot of this, and it concerns me that public newspapers need the subsidizing of the government to keep them alive. And so, for that, I'll be voting no on it, but thank you.
Any other questions, members? Any other concerns? Anybody in the audience who wishes to testify? If not, Senator Dahl, if you could move your bill.
Madam Chair, I move Senate File 1506 be recommended to pass and sent to floor?
To the floor, yes.
Send to the floor.
All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator. Senator, I think we have your next bill if you would like to stay there.
Yes, this should be very quick, Madam.
1499.
Madam Chair. Senate File 1499 is just really extending a deadline on a bill that we passed off the floor last year, 58-0, which was allowed Sanitary Sewer District, Cedar Lake area, to hook up with the City of New Prague. Both City of New Prague and the Cedar Lake Area Township are all aboard. Matter of fact, things were proceeding very nicely. However, as the original bill said that it went into effect when they've completed their compliance with Minnesota statutes. Unfortunately, a deadline was missed, and the Attorney General's office, I believe, suggested that we by legislature just extend the deadline. I have here Terry Moss, Township Supervisor, actually for Helena Township, who can explain maybe a few sentences as well about what this bill actually does.
Welcome to our committee, Mr. Mass. If you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Terry Mays, Township Supervisor, Helena Township, Scott County. Thank you, Madam Chair and Council members. Basically, what it amounted to is there was a statute that we were supposed to have the Cedar Lake Sewer District file a letter with the Secretary of State by the start of the session in January of this year. And it was unbeknownst to us until about the middle of February we found out about it. And I talked to the Secretary of State office attorneys, and they said that no precedent had been made previously to be able to alter that other than coming back to you and have a bill passed to extend the date. And the reason I am here as a township member versus the Cedar Lake Sewer District is we had come to the Sewer District to be able to dissolve the Cedar Lake Sewer District to dissolve our subordinate sewer district and tie into theirs. It was our initiative, so it's basically my job to now take care of that. They will be sending the letter to the Secretary of State when this bill, hopefully when this bill passes for the extension.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl.
And I inadvertently said Attorney General, but I meant Secretary of State. Thank you.
Any questions, members? Any comments? Anybody else who wishes to testify? If not, Senator, if you could proceed with your motion.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 1499 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Senator Sparks.
Sorry.
We are now ready for you. It's Senate File 764.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members, and appreciate your working with the schedule. Obviously, with the deadline, it's a very busy time. But Senate File 764, and this legislation borrows from some successful programs in our neighboring states and creates a three-pronged approach to address workforce housing needs in greater Minnesota. One part of that is to create an Office of Housing in the Department of Employment and Economic Development to operate the grant program and coordinate efforts across the state. I know you have a busy schedule, Madam Chair and members, so I would like to turn over to my testifiers to explain the bill a little bit further. But I do have, I believe you have an A8 author's amendment.
Yes, Senator Sparks, we have the A8 amendment, which is the is kind of a delete all amendment, so we need to move that so that you can continue to talk about it. Senator Johnson moves the 8-8 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Yeah.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. It's adopted.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. If it's okay with you, then I think it's Craig
or Dan. Yeah.
Mr. Dorman.
Yes, please proceed. If you could identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Dorman. I'm the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. The Greater Minnesota Partnership, for those of you who don't know, we have roughly 100 members, EDAs, Chambers of Commerce, private businesses, nonprofits throughout Greater Minnesota that have come together to try to get better tools for economic development, creating economic development opportunities, not just more jobs, but better jobs in Greater Minnesota. And one of the issues that the our members feel are critical to economic development in Greater Minnesota is workforce housing. And it's a problem no matter which part of the state you go to, from Worthington to War Road and all points in between. The bill that's before you, as amended, has several different components to it. One is a tax credit. That would, we believe, is a market problem. The market is not responding to the need. We think that with the stimulation, the market will begin to function much better. But it's a tax credit that would go to the developer in order to build workforce housing in Greater Minnesota. And the distinction to keep in mind is that we're not talking about people that would qualify for low-income housing. It's a different set of workers, really. It's, you know, in my hometown, which is in Senator Sparks' district in Albert Lee, we hear about it from the school district for beginning teachers. We hear about it from the medical center with beginning nurses that just cannot find adequate housing. You go to Jackson, Minnesota, you have manufacturer there where now 26% of its workforce comes from more than 30 miles away. So it's a real critical problem. So the first part of the bill is a tax credit that would stimulate that. The second part of the bill is workforce housing grants, somewhat similar to the but not entirely similar to the pilot program that passed last year. And the third piece that we think is critically important and the reason for our visit to your committee today is the Office of Workforce Housing. The Office of Workforce Housing would be held within DEED. We are patterning it after the Broadband Office, which was established in statute, I believe, 2 years ago, prior to even the funding of last year. But the idea is that we think that if there's a Office of Workforce Housing within DEED, they would be able to focus on this issue or this need, provide a lot of backup and support to our communities that are in need of workforce housing. In general, Madam Chair, that's how the bill functions. There are two other testifiers here as well. I don't know if you want to take questions all at the end or whatever you prefer, or I could take any questions directed at me now.
Thank you. Let's proceed with the testimony and we will answer questions. I want to make sure that there is a form at front that you really, we don't have your names and we need to spell them correctly, so if you could please sign that form. Please proceed.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Craig Clark, City Administrator for the City of Austin. Unfortunately, I need to stand before you today and tell you that Austin and many parts of Greater Minnesota, our housing market, we haven't seen a market rate housing since bell bottoms were hip in the 70s. Our housing market is broken, and before you today is a targeted effort to both grow jobs and incentivize work. The cost of construction, low prevailing rents, lack of developer capacity and wage limitations have led to vacancy rates that are in the single digits and an explosion of job vacancy rates in greater Minnesota. There's jobs to be had if we have places for these folks to live. This is an economic development tool to bridge the gap and spur job growth. We need an approach that addresses affordable housing in the state as well as workforce housing. We appreciate the organized mission of MHFA, but feel the effort is best centered at DEED, and an economic development tool that this is intended to be finds its rightful place within the Department of Employee and Economic Development. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Brad Chapoulos. I'm the Director of Community and Economic Development, as well as the Interim City Administrator for the City of Worthington. Thank you for your time and consideration. I want to follow up on the comments that my Mr. Clark has provided, talk about that this bill is an economic development mission. The City of Worthington has had a population growth of over 13% each of the last two decades. Each of our employers are at a point where they're at a point of expansion. The 0% vacancy rate that is currently in Worthington market would indicate that we are at a standstill between economic development and housing needs. Due to the 0% vacancy, we've had a population within our community that has had to make a decision based on a necessity rather than choice. We have a good percentage of our workforce that is coming from out of the region or working in Worthington, or they are making decisions that are out of necessity. Our persons per household within the City of Worthington has gone from 2.42 in 2000 to 2.86 persons per household in 2010. In trying to grasp a reasoning for the situation, we did conduct a housing needs assessment in 2013 that identified a need for over 500 housing units between now and 2020 to be able to maintain the economic growth that we've been encountering over the last 15 years. 300 of those are of the rental necessity, and within our needs assessment, we've contacted people within the healthcare, the education, and the biosciences, all indicating that their biggest challenge in recruitment is housing. For those reasons, we want to look at ways outside of the box in which we've, as a state, have been doing economic development and looking at the housing. We know MHFA does a good job in providing the resources for those that meet the definition of low to moderate income, and we believe that this is a little bit greater than that. And we thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Senator Sparks, I'm trying to review the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency's kind of duties and what they do. And I'm curious as to how would they coordinate these efforts, because they have, you know, in terms of kind of looking at grant appropriation and identifying issues in general for housing. And could you tell us a little bit kind of what your vision is?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. You know, we took a look at that very thing as we were thinking about what we would advocate for as an organization. And in general, if you look at the website, Housing Finance, Minnesota Housing offers products and services to help Minnesotans buy, fix up their homes, and to stabilize neighborhoods, communities, and families. And that's a great mission. However, we're talking about something different that does not fit into that. We're talking about workforce housing, which is really more about growing the community as opposed to stabilizing or fixing up existing homes. The problems in many of the communities in greater Minnesota aren't stabilization issues that would be addressed and are addressed by Minnesota Housing Finance programs. Rather, they are issues of, again, market failure. You have many of our communities. Mr. Clark referenced Austin. I can tell you in Albert Lea, market rate housing hasn't been built for over 30 years. The market is not functioning at that level. You know, you've seen some high-end stuff, maybe not a lot of it that's been built, but not for regular folks that, you know, And the other reason to address this is that in greater Minnesota, we have a much higher job vacancy rate than in the metropolitan area. Since 2006, our job vacancy rate in greater Minnesota is up about 58%, where in the metropolitan area, it's only 6%. These are jobs that are there, open, ready, waiting for someone to take them, and there's a couple things that are preventing that. One of the largest factors is workforce housing. So that's kind of the difference in the need. It's really a different way of looking at it. This is more about economic development than it is community stabilization.
I understand the difference, but regardless, I think there has to be some coordination because this is the same issue. I just don't see any language in here for coordinating efforts.
I don't have the bill in front of me. I'd point to the line item, but there's a line item that refers to the duties of the Office of Workforce Housing, and one of their duties of that person would be to coordinate with Minnesota Housing Finance, because if there are instances where it would make more sense to use the Minnesota Housing Finance programs, that's what should be done.
Thank you. Senator Hayden.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Sparks for bringing this forward. It sounds like we have a little bit of a chicken and the egg going on here, where you have jobs that can't be filled because people don't have places to live that are close by, but you don't have a developable market because the developers aren't sure that there's going to be people to live there that are going to come down there, so you can't quite align those, because it would seem to me that if you had a need, if there was people there, then the developer would come in and know that they were going to get their money back, if you will, or the banks would know as well, because people would live there. But it sounds like to me that you don't have confidence in the developer's market and all that comes with it, the banks and everybody else, because even though you know you think you can attract people, but since they're not there, they don't want to take the risk, or the banks won't loan the money. Is that essentially what we're kind of dealing with?
And Madam Chair, Senator, absolutely. Essentially what we have is local developers. Part of it, we're small enough in our rural communities that having plumbers and electricians and having the capacity to build some of these units, we're not seeing necessarily that in place in a lot of instances. And then if a developer is, you know, they're looking at developing in a proven market and that sort of thing, they've taken those opportunities rather than developing greater Minnesota. So that's been the particular market challenge for us. The rents they couldn't necessarily afford, but any developer is risk adverse and wanting to make sure that there's going to be people that take those units. If they're going to spend a fixed amount, whether it be in a metropolitan area or greater Minnesota, they've chosen to go to the metropolitan area.
Good. Thank you, and Madam Chair. So Senator Sparks, I think this is a pretty good idea. I would echo the chair's sentiment about working closely with MHFA, and maybe, and I know that that's kind of it starts in your committee a little bit, but really to look at what are those opportunities along with the deed issues. But I really do think that if we expand, we do that in affordable housing in the metro all the time, where we start to subsidize and buy down the affordability. And I think that a certain concept in greater Minnesota would be the same thing, that if we could help you buy down the cost of those developments and the state take some of that risk, I think that then folks would then come to your communities and then they can fill those jobs, and then at that point you get the market working. So I would really hope, I didn't read the whole bill, but I really would hope, Senator Sparks, that you could strengthen the coordination with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency along with DEED in order to come up with this solution. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And this is an interesting bill. I'm wondering now, would this qualify for manufactured housing as well? And the reason I ask that is that people think that the metro area, all the jobs pay well and everyone can afford housing. And in my district, I have currently 9 manufactured housing courts of like 300 people each. So that's a lot of people who make low wages and can't afford market rate housing. And it works quite well. And I noticed that you're looking at units up to $250,000, which is pretty pricey compared to my district, and no less than $75,000. And I'm just thinking the taxpayer dollars for the grants would go further if you were to utilize manufactured housing courts like the nine that I have in my district for low-income working people.
Senator Sparks, are you testifiers?
Madam Secretary, or Madam Chair, Senators, yes, we have looked at that. In fact, in the city of Worthington, our local HRA is working with a local manufactured housing builder, and we're taking a little bit of different approach. Instead of a mobile or a manufactured home, we are doing a townhouse development. That's a 48-unit townhouse development that is built right in the manufacturer's plant that is geared towards providing housing for that lower income to the middle income population. That project began in October of last year. It's a $6.5 million project. And just to kind of illustrate the need for a tax credit or other type of financing, based upon the market, that $6.5 million project can only garner $3.9 million in financing through the traditional lending sources, which left a $1.6 million gap. The city of Worthington, thankfully, due to the sale of its local hospital, had money set aside for housing development and put the $1.6 million, a low-interest loan, to make that project go forward.
Thank you. Senator Scalzi.
So how much per unit would that be for that type of housing?
It's in that 115 to 120 range.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sparks. I actually have a number of issues or questions, I guess, for the bill. The first maybe is more of a statement, and you can shed some additional light with your testifiers. But knowing what I know about, I grew up in a family in real estate, and so market prices are set, you know, are largely determined by agents and you know, everybody by comparable market analysis. So previous sales, footage, depending on how new the property is. So when you're making a decision about whether or not you're going to build housing in a particular community, you'll take a look at the comparable market analysis, and you'll decide the price point, and you'll develop accordingly. So whether there's a subsidy or not, in other words, wouldn't affect the CMA on the front end or the comparable market analysis on the front end. It would just allow for the developer to maybe sell at a lower price point, but that doesn't necessarily affect what the overall market average price would be for X number of square foot in this area based on previous sales. So, in other words, I guess what I'm saying is if there's jobs and there's economic opportunity. I know we have significant federal support for housing in terms of financing, especially for first-time home buyers. Explain to me how this program is actually going to increase capacity. In other words, if there's vast swaths of real estate where there's an opportunity to sell at a particular price point, which anybody, any agent can determine, how is this subsidy going to fill those residences?
Senator Sparks or
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, to answer your question, the reality in Worthington, and I understand it to be the same in similar communities throughout rural Minnesota, is the fact that there hasn't been construction of multifamily. In Worthington alone, since 1990, there's only been three projects that equal about 80 units that have been built within the city of Worthington. All of them have either been a low-income housing tax credit project or been financed through a housing TIF district. That themselves, as you indicated, an appraisal will come back and identify. Being that there are no comparables, most of those properties are still under ownership because of tax implications, may that be through HUD programs or MHFA through the tax credits, we don't see the turnover in ownership. So it's much more difficult for an appraiser to take the approach in regards to comparable sales. They end up having to go to an income-based approach, and based upon the prevailing rent rates in rural Minnesota, they can't cash flow. I'll just use, again, the Worthington HRA project itself, a $6.5 million project. The appraisal came back at 5.2. That just creates a gap in the market that the private sector at this point in time has yet to take that on. We believe that the tax credit program itself, no different than the wind energy or the angel investment group, would invest private sector money to jumpstart that economy.
Madam Chair.
Peterson.
But the appraisal is not pulled out of thin air. The appraisal is based upon tangible statistics, and actually what you'll do, if you pump $1 million in state aid into a project, is you're artificially increasing, you're actually increasing the cost for, in a way that otherwise there would be no way to finance it. So, in fact, you're increasing the average cost of housing based on comparable sales in greater Minnesota. Wouldn't it also be better to particularly – well, I'll let you answer that question, and then I'll make my next statement, I guess.
Please. Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure what the second question was, if it differs from the first one, but what I can tell you is that in a community – and I'll speak more about Alberley because I was the EDA director there for 6.5 years – prior to this, and what I can tell you is it's very difficult for an appraiser to come up with comparables because there has been no property built in over 30 years, so they'll have to go to other communities to try to find comparables, and it's not really based on what's happening in the marketplace, and so that is a problem. It's a problem for appraisers to actually find comparables when you haven't seen buildings built. The other example, last year there was $400,000, I believe, sent to Roseau for a pilot project. They have the same problem there. The cost on that project about $4.5 million. The appraisal came back at about $2.8 million. It creates a problem when you go to try to get something like that financed. And you drill down into that, and it's because it's really hard to find a comparable that is really truly comparable on modern property. I've read several city housing studies. I'll use the one from Albert Lee again because I'm most familiar with it, but the theme is in several of them. If you look at that, you'd say about the most you're going to get for a one-bedroom apartment is $800. Okay, I get that. I know the building because it's a small town. I can tell you what building it is. I'm surprised you get $800 for it because it's ancient. It isn't very darn nice, but that's the only game in town you've got. That's what you've got. We actually believe that if we do this for a few years, I don't think we'll be doing it permanently, but if we do it for a few years, stimulate the economy in these communities, that we think that the market will start to respond. You'll start to get better comparables. You'll start to get better appraisals, and we won't be doing this forever.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for helping me understand the situation. So the focus seems to be more on multi-unit development versus, because anybody right now could go, if they had the financing and the means, could go build a single-family home just about anywhere, maybe a little bit more expensive because of rural sewer and things, those sorts of implications. But
Mr. Dorman.
This bill, Madam Chair, members, this bill is targeted at multifamily housing. We believe that, I use the city of Jackson as an example, you build quality multifamily housing, people will then not be driving over 30 miles to get to work. They'll establish themselves in the community after a year or two, much like many people in this room, you go from that apartment to your first home. So we believe that in the long run, this will stimulate single-family growth and will help grow the community.
Senator Peterson.
Just thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of points. I do have some hesitation when we look at housing finance in particular. Your situation is sort of the opposite of what's happening in the inner city, lower income communities where we have plenty of people but not enough housing. If I were to, not everything's an either or, but if I were to make the choice, I would argue that where you live is to some extent a market choice in and of itself. We have a great amount of need. We have tremendous waiting lists for voucher programs and other things of the like, and the choice was between providing housing for low-income folks that don't have housing at all versus building housing where we hope people will live, I think is an important consideration. And also, I'm a bit leery about, again, the state, and this is entirely unrelated, but the state seems to, I think, in some cases, be subsidizing lower-wage jobs that they couldn't actually get away with paying the wage if they didn't have this state support. So in other words, you know, you mentioned a subdivision or development that's within the close walking proximity of a housing development. We have government providing housing at a rate that the market wouldn't bear, and then allowing people to basically allowing these companies to pay people wages that otherwise they would never be able to attract people to. I think are all sorts of considerations when we get into playing with, you know, or making determinations about, quote unquote, whether the market is broken or not. For what it's worth, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Senator, and that's why we have some very good bills to support some of the workers that organize themselves to go against that, because we have that in health care, we have that in housing, we have that happening all over. I have a question in Subdivision 7, if you could explain that to me, any of the testifiers or Senator Sparks. I'm curious about the taxpayer qualified investment. So it's line 419, it says that a taxpayer who makes a qualified investment of a qualified workforce and a qualified workforce housing project is allowed a tax credit for 50% of the amount of the qualified investment. I'm just curious as to how is that typical, a 50%? Is that lower than what you typically offer? Is that higher? What is the range when you say 50% with respect to the incentive that you are offering through this project?
Madam Chair, members, the 50% would be, depending on what you look at. First of all, there's not really a similar program in Minnesota. So if we look at our neighboring states, Iowa has a similar program, and their credit is at 30%. North Dakota has one. It's really more designed for low income, but we did take a look at that and borrow some of their ideas, and that's an 80% credit. So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all, but what the bill says up to 50% certainly does not have to be, but it also limits it to no more than $1 million per investor.
And I'm sure, Senator, you will deal with these questions in taxes, but I was curious as to why selecting the 50%. And I also would like to offer a friendly amendment, Senator Sparks, for the coordination. You have consultation on line 235. It says consult with the housing finance. And I'd like to offer a friendly amendment that says consult and coordinate with the housing. And, you know, these are very different words. Consulting, you know, means you just kind of let them know. But I think that there has to be an effort to coordinate and figure out, you know, what they are doing, what you're doing, so that there are no problems in the future.
Madam Chair, I couldn't agree with you more, and I appreciate all the discussion we're having here today, taking, obviously, your comments, Senator Hayden, Senator Scalzi, and Senator Peterson's. We have had several meetings with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. We want to make sure that they're a part of this. We talked with the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development and want them to work together. So we'll continue to do that. And I know that Senator Scalzi, as Vice Chair of the Bonding Committee, knows that I've been a champion for many of the low-income and moderate-income bonding proposals in the past, and we'll continue to do that. So I think there's room for both things, hopefully. But obviously, I would accept that as a friendly amendment. Madam Chair, would
thank you.
Certainly continue to work with those folks.
So all of those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed say no. Amendment is adopted. So it's just simply to add the word coordinate on line 236, if you...
235,
excuse me. Any other questions? Last word from your testifier.
Chair, members, I want to add Senator Sparks' comments that this isn't an either or proposition between affordable housing and workforce housing. If you look at rural communities, our housing studies indicate need at all levels of that, and we're just trying to also encourage those programs that otherwise their wages are too high to qualify for these programs and move forward job creation.
Thank you. Okay, I need a motion for Senator Sparks.
So
I understand, Senator, that it doesn't need to go to judiciary, but it probably has to go to taxes from here.
Finance?
Or finance? I don't know which order. We don't know the order, but we'll send it to finance.
Okay.
So
moved.
Senator Hayden moves Senate File 764 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to Finance. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
No. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members.
Motion passes. Thank you. All right. Okay, Senator Scalzi, we do have your bill. Senator Scalzi, you have Senate File 634. Please proceed.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Yes, Senate File 634 is the Gambling Control Board's policy bill. It relates to charitable gambling activity, and there is an author's amendment. This is our first stop. I believe it's the A1 amendment, which you may be passing out at this point. Until the members have it, do you want me to just go through the bill?
This is a very technical amendment, Senator, so you can go ahead and move it.
Okay, I would move the A1 amendment.
All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Please go ahead, Senator.
And thank you. And yes, this is the policy bill that would simplify the monthly reporting requirements for the charities and ease the licensing restrictions. And it would ease the regulations for nursing home bingo. Currently, nursing homes are restricted by law to only have two occasions of bingo per week. And I don't know how you feel, but that seems to me to be quite restrictive. So this would change that. And it also would clarify that electronic gaming would only be used at on-sale establishments. And the bill does not include any new or expanded gaming formats. So I have with me here today Tom Barrett, who's the executive director of the Gambling Control Board, and he can walk through the bill for you.
Welcome, Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Again, my name is Tom Barrett, executive director. I appreciate the committee's understanding and hearing this policy bill. We really haven't had much in the way of a policy bill the last couple of years. But this is an opportunity where the board, working with representatives from the industry, to look at some clarifying issues. As Senator Scalzi mentioned, nursing home bingo, that's not the biggest thing on our regulatory radar, but it was an issue that was brought up during the last year as far as why is there a limit on the number of nights or days, and to that extent, even visitors to a nursing home couldn't participate in bingo. So we took a number of things, ran it through the board. Like I said, we met with representatives from the industry. Allied Charities represents a good number of charities are supporting this language as well. There's no fiscal impact. There's no judiciary impact. But it does provide some latitude to the charities that are conducting bingo in terms of ease of reporting, lifting of restrictions as relates to merging. When we see a charity go out of business, for whatever reasons, maybe due to lack of interest, they can merge a little easier under this provision. But all in all, certainly a bill that's supported by the board and regulatory oversight, as well as the charities and industry that we regulate.
Thank you, members. Do you have any questions for Senator Scalzi or Mr. Barrett? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify? If not, Senator Scalzi, we're ready for your motion.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and members. I would move Senate File 634 as amended be recommended to pass.
And sent to the floor.
And sent to the floor.
All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator. Next, we have Senator Pappas. I think Senator Hayden, where he went. But maybe Senator Pappas, if you could.
Thank you.
Senator Pappas has Senate File 1663.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I do have an author's amendment, the A-15 amendment.
A-15 amendment, members?
Yes.
Staff, do we have it?
The important part of the amendment is we're deleting Section 21 and 22, which I think was the controversial sections of the bill.
We appreciate that, Senator. Okay. Of the amendment, A-15 amendment. Senator Pappas moves the A-15 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1663 are housekeeping changes for the Minnesota Racing Commission. I have with me Mr. Tom DePasquale. And there are also some licensing changes that would allow multi-year licensing for certain occupations and some modest license fee increases. These changes are long overdue and are in step with other racing jurisdictions, will reduce administrative costs, and are necessary to meet the legislature's directive, which is to impose fees on the racing and card playing industry sufficient to recover the operating costs of the commission. And these changes are going to subsequently be implemented by notice and by rulemaking. There's also modest changes to the investigative and enforcement authority, which I think is more under the purview of the Judiciary Committee. Madam Chair, Mr. DePasquale can go through the bill section by section if the committee would like, since this is our jurisdiction, and I'll ask him to kind of do it briefly and quickly.
Yes, Senator Pappas, that will be good. Please go ahead and identify yourself, and if you could walk us
Thank
through
you,
the
Madam
bill.
Chair. Tom DePasquale, Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, and with me is Joe Skurdo, Deputy Director of the Commission. And thank you, Senator Pappas. Members and Madam Chair, in my prior life, I spent 3 decades counseling one of our great companies on some of the most complex federal and state statutory frameworks, and after 15 months of dealing with Chapter 240, I'm still scratching my head about how to interpret some of this. In the last year, we've seen a dispute over its interpretation for purse contributions to the horse person's account. We have situations where the tracks are applying the statute differently, even though only one interpretation can be correct. There has been ambiguity concerning the nature and extent of the Commission's authority and how the powers are differentiated between the Commission and the Executive Director. And we had an unduly long search for Executive Director because of constraints on the qualifications. So my first inclination was to throw the whole thing overboard and start over like some jurisdictions have done, but out of deference to those many in this room who've spent 35 years working with the statute, I decided a more modest approach was in order. So that's what you have before you. And I'll take you through, for the Reader's Digest portion of this, and I should say before I start that we have representatives from the tracks and the horsepersons groups who are in support of this. What you have in front of you represents 6 months of work inside the commission, several months of working with the interested parties to develop a bill that the industry fully supports. Sections 1 through 6 of the bill are amendments to the definitional sections. These, for the most part, incorporate definitions that are standard in the industry and taken from model rules that are used in other jurisdictions or from federal law. The definition for steward is necessary to make clear that even though we use the word steward throughout the statute, we also mean judges who are their counterparts in the standard bred industry. So the use of stewards in the statute reflects the fact that the statute was drafted before we had standard bred racing in Minnesota. Section 7 broadens the search criteria for appointment of an executive director beyond those who are experienced in the administration and regulation of paramutual racing. I think the governor's staff and the state had a difficult time finding qualified people
who came only from the industry, and I think it's an unnecessarily narrowing of the criteria for executive director. Section 8 deals with commission powers and duties. I've learned in the last year that unless it's explicit in the statute, an agency does not have subpoena authority. And although we have the responsibility of conducting extensive investigations and background searches, and we can compel attendance of witnesses and production of documents, it only gives subpoena authority to the stewards in the other part of the statute, and strangely enough, does not grant it explicitly to the commission. And so I've sought to cure that by making it clear that we have subpoena authority. I noticed in my search today that the Gambling Control Board and Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division have subpoena authority, but the Racing Commission does not. Section 9 is an amendment to the affidavit that we require all Class C license applicants to fill out. And you'll note on line 3.31 that if you are found guilty of a violation of rule relating to horse racing, pari-mutuel betting, or any other form of gambling, which is a serious violation, you're disqualified. But if you turn to sub 6, it does not state pari-mutuel betting or any other form of gambling, which means that you could commit crimes or rule violations in card rooms that may not have the same impact as if they had been committed on the backside or at a racing violation. The other change here is that we don't think it should make a difference whether that offense is committed in Minnesota or elsewhere. And so we've added the words, or another jurisdiction, which takes account of the fact that in our industry, there is reciprocity between jurisdictions in terms of sharing information on violations. And so this would allow us to take into account in licensing offenses that are committed in other jurisdictions. Section 10 provides for multi-year licensing. Most jurisdictions offer this service or benefit to licensees, and in particular, owners are the category of licensees that we would consider for multi-year licensing. We have to make that change by rule, and we intend to do that in the near future. Section 11, I want to draw your attention first to Section 10, just above on line 4.16. Many of the provisions of the statute put the integrity of racing and the protection of public health, welfare, and safety on the same plane. But you'll notice in the revocation and suspension provisions that we're allowed to revoke or suspend licenses to protect the integrity of racing, but absent from that criterion is the protection of public health, welfare, or safety, which I consider a gap in our duties and ability to protect public health, welfare, and safety. So we propose adding that. The rest of that section, there's another section on 5, line 5.2, that provides that a license could be suspended summarily in order to protect public health, welfare, or safety. Section 12 deals with license fees and removes the historical ceiling of $100 for a license. In Minnesota, we have about 30 classifications of licensees. Most of them are $50 or less. There's only two or three categories that pay $100, and that includes gaming vendors and pari-mutuel vendors, large multinational companies that provide equipment that is essential to the integrity of racetrack and commission operations. And those people right now pay only $100. Our intent is to amend the rules and require certain of those entities to pay a higher license fee. Again, that has to go through notice and comment rulemaking, has to be approved by the governor and the Office of Administrative Hearings, and it has to come back to the legislature for approval because this statute requires any fee increases to be approved by the legislature. So we will be returning with a specific menu of license fees. Section 13, deals with purses. First of all, I want to make clear that this does not involve state money. This is money that is wagered in the card rooms and at the tracks, and there are formulas for set aside of those amounts for purses, and that formula has been needlessly complex over the years. It's been interpreted different ways.
and the Office of Legislative Auditor in his audit last year suggested we simplify and clarify this language. So Deputy Director Skurdo has been in discussions with the industry groups, the horse persons, and the tracks, and we have arrived at one number which will allow easier accounting and administration of purse contributions to purses, and that's set forth in line 6.2. And that's 37% of net revenues from simulcast handle. And the parties have agreed to that number. On line 6.29, it's really just clarification. There's not a substantive change there. The amendment that was adopted just now deals with line 7.14 and money that is taken from simulcast wagering and given over to purses and the Breeders' Fund in Minnesota. Section 14 is a housekeeping matter that simply changes separate pools to commingled pools, which is the norm nowadays. When you wager on races, the pools are commingled into one pool at the host track, and that's the way it's done around the country. Section 15, this is a good example of the ambiguities in the statute. The legislature declared that amounts wagered in the card rooms shall be set aside at specific percentages for contributions to purse payments. But then there was language further down in this section that said, in spite of the legislature's declaration that it shall be 10% or 14%, depending on the level that we're at, the horse persons and the tracks can agree otherwise. And that resulted, once again, in disparate interpretations as between the two tracks and the horse person associations. We have made it clear in this statute or bill that those are floors, the 10% and 14%, and that the parties can negotiate those percentages upward but not downward. Section 16 is another clarification, which is conforming the statute to the practices of the tracks for purposes of contributions to Breeders' Fund from amounts wagered at simulcast during simulcast racing. Section 17 is really just a deletion of a term that is an anachronism. Full card simulcasts are the norm nowadays. This term goes back to when you used to take simulcast wagering on one race like the Kentucky Derby, and there were different rules that applied if it was less than full card simulcasting, but nowadays it's all full card simulcasting, so there's no need to have that term. Section 18 is a slight enhancement of enforcement authority of the stewards. Right now, the stewards have authority to impose penalties or fines of up to $2,000, and anything beyond that has to go to the full commission. This is administratively cumbersome. It doesn't allow the stewards, who basically have plenary authority on the backside and during racing, to impose penalties that are already authorized in rule for serious offenses, and therefore we want their authority to be consistent with the rule that's already been promulgated on penalty. Section 19 relates to fines and makes clear that the threshold for a contested case is now $5,000 rather than $2,000. The reason this is a disincentive to enforcement is contested cases, however rare they may be, and we've only had a couple in our history, cost about $10,000 to go before an administrative law judge and enforce the rules. If the threshold is $2,000, we're actually spending more money to enforce than we're recovering for the state. And so this provision raises the threshold for a contested case to $5,000 from $2,000, and paragraph B requires that from the amounts recovered, our reasonable attorney's fees and other costs can be used to reimburse the commission. Section 20 makes it clear that nowadays our authority to promulgate rules regarding communications applies to both wired and wireless communications, which of course is the norm. I also note that under the Federal Wire Act, the word wired is defined to include wireless, so this is consistent with federal law. The change in subparagraph J, there's a distinction between therapeutic medications, which are permitted, and prohibited medications, which are not. Prohibited medications can be performance-enhancing, or they can jeopardize the welfare of the horses and the people that ride them. This provision will allow the Commission to promulgate a rule to regulate the administration of prohibited substances when horses are out of competition. They may be on the farm, they may be at a training facility, or they may be on the backside. We will promulgate a rule that if you are eligible to race in Minnesota, we can test for prohibited substances at any time. Sections 21 and 22 have been withdrawn, and Section 23 relates to section or chapter 364, which places limits on the criminal background data that is available to licensing authorities. And there's already an exception for the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, but there's not an exception for the Racing Commission. We learned recently that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension reclassified the background data that we're privy to, doing licensing checks for applicants. And under that reclassification, we are not getting full criminal background checks on applicants. And we talked to the revisor's office and other authorities, and they said the 240.08 makes it clear that the commission should have access to all criminal background checks as part of our license background. And finally, there is a repealer for two definitions that are obsolete and no longer used in the statute. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have any questions for the testifier, for Senator Pappas? Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify? If not, Senator Pappas, you may move
Madam
your
Chair,
bill.
I move that Senate Bill 1663 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the
Judiciary.
Right.
All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Senator. Senator Hayden, you have Senate File 1275.
He started going section by section. I guess
thank you, Madam Chair, members. I have Senate File 1275. Madam Chair, members, File 1275 will allow Minnesota to continue and build on its history of implementing an innovative approach to healthcare reform. Senate File 1275 was first heard in Senator Sharon's HHS committee, and it's before you now because it creates a task force. When creating the task force, we tried to be broad and inclusive. It's a 26-member board with diverse representation, including care providers, representatives from the insurance industry, and consumers. We want the task force to be able to have a robust discussion, and we think this is a good group to have that discussion. Now I'll turn it over to Liz Doyle, who's the Associate Director at Take Action Minnesota, to speak briefly about the bill and answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Doyle.
Great. Liz Doyle, Associate Director, Take Action Minnesota. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. Just to say a few more sentences about the topic of this working group, the 1332 waiver is a provision of the Affordable Care Act, and it's designed to allow states greater flexibility in implementation of the ACA beginning in 2017. There are particular components under the 1332 waiver of the Affordable Care Act that you can waive, taking advantage of this waiver opportunity. It's not the entirety of the federal law, but there are provisions related to the state exchange, to the employer mandate, to the individual mandate, to the cost-sharing reductions in premium and assistance that are part of the components that a state could choose to waive under the Affordable Care Act through this waiver process. There are also pretty clear parameters under the Affordable Care Act of standards that are set for states that have to meet essentially certain standards of coverage and equivalent cost to the current options available on the state-based exchange. So it's not a completely open door, but it allows states to move forward on health reform, to take advantage of this opportunity to design components of the Affordable Care Act in ways that may work better at the state level. And that is, as Senator Hayden mentioned, the intent of this bill. I think a couple quick opportunities I might mention for Minnesota include streamlining of the public programs, looking at issues of affordability over 200% of the federal poverty level, and aligning some of our payment methodologies to improve things like continuity of care and the reduction of health inequities in our state. It's a broad stakeholder group designed to pull in a diverse group of individuals who would be interested in this conversation to start thinking about what could a next generation of healthcare reform look like in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. Members, do you have any questions for Senator Hayden or the testifier? If not, Senator Hayden, could you move?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move Senate File 1275, and I think its next stop would be finance.
That's correct.
Yep.
Senator Hayden moves Senate File 1275 to be recommended to pass and be referred to finance. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no.
No.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Senator. Senators, thank you very much. I think we made tremendous progress. We're making progress little by little. We keep receiving a lot of bills, so we will do our best to move them. We will meet on Wednesday about the same time. Hopefully, we will be able to finish as many as we can, and we will have a short agenda for Friday. But we are planning to meet on Friday because we have too many bills, and I don't think you want to come in the evening, so... we will do the same thing we did last. Another thing that I want to make sure that you know, and please, this is for my lead senator as well, please talk to members and let them know about their bills, that they really need to communicate with you. Sometimes I'm just surprised that we have bills that people say, well, you know, there's no problem, no controversy, and then they don't have the votes here. So everybody has to come and work with all of you. All of you have to come and ask whether or not your bill has the votes to pass. I think it's incredibly important that you do that. And, you know, we're scheduling bills as they come, and when we know that they have the votes, I just put them in the agenda. So I want to make sure that you talk to members about it, and that if you have a bill that is coming before us, you are doing your work to lobby for your bill. So with that, we will adjourn for today. Thank you.